Hello and welcome to another episode of The Coder Career with me, Cameron Blackwood. For those of you who are not familiar, I am now a software engineer, but I used to be a technical recruiter. So I've created this podcast so that you can learn from my experience of both sides of the table. And I interview people from a wide variety of backgrounds, both in technical and non-technical roles that can help you break into the tech industry. And if you're already in it, level up within it. Today, my guest is a friend of mine who I worked with for quite a while, actually. I had a really good time working with him. He's one of the funniest blokes I've ever met. It's Sam Cox. He's had a ton of experience in the technical recruitment industry, both externally and internally. So he has so much insight to give. So today's episode is going to be a real corker, I think. Sam, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, mate. Thanks for having me on.
No worries at all. My pleasure. So would you like to give the listeners just a bit of background to who you are and what your current role is?
Yeah, sure. So, as you mentioned, a bit of experience within recruitment. So I recently found out it's been 10 years, which was nice. Didn't realize it was quite that long. I started out in an RPO, then moved down to London in 2013 and went through some agencies. And then obviously joined Talent with worked alongside yourself. And now I'm working internally at a company called Form3, sort of cloud-based payments as a service company. 5 years, our birthday was on Monday, actually, 5 years. So we've moved into more of a scale-up now. So really exciting time to be working there. I started in the engineering side, but now I'm heading up the product recruitment. So obviously still a focus on tech, but more from the product side than engineering.
It's very fashionable, cloud payments. Must be a cool company to work for.
Yeah, and like I said, been 5 years, so it's come kind of exposed in the last two, so it's quite good that they got in there early. Software's all cloud based, it's all in Golang. It's very cool. Awesome. It's quite easy to attract people, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I can imagine from an engineering perspective, that is a pretty cool prospect. Yeah. So normally what I like to do to warm things up a little bit on the podcast and so people can get to know you a bit better is just a few quick fire questions. No pressure here, but some pressure. So the first question is, what was your first personal computer?
Yeah, so one of my earliest memories was playing the Neighbours video game. And I'm pretty sure that was on a Commodore 64.
There was a Neighbours video, as in the Australian soap.
Yeah. So you went around delivering newspapers. So didn't really have anything to do with the soap. But I remember that being the first time I remember being on a computer. That shows my age again. There was that. Then obviously we had the family computer. I have no idea what make it was. But that was my earliest memory was a Commodore 64.
That's an iconic machine, to be fair.
It was the worst game, probably. I don't know why we had that one. Didn't have anything else.
The thing about gaming back then is just so much random stuff would get a game, and I absolutely love that something that is now on Channel 5 had a video game. So that is awesome. Yeah, I can't believe you never told me about that. That is so.
No, I know. I think the production of video games back then was you could probably knock that out in a week, like the ET game. So why don't you? Oh think yeah, it was sure.
The ET game's notorious, isn't it? They buried them all in the desert because they were so bad.
Someone dug them up as well. And I think they made a bit of money from the guy who dug them up.
That's a weird story, that one. And for the next quickfire question, what's your favourite tech city in the world?
Yeah, I guess in terms of where I've actually visited, I'm obviously a bit biased being in London, but I think London's, in terms of Europe, probably the biggest tech city. Outside of San Francisco, I'd say it's probably the most iconic and biggest for tech. But I think personally, one place I want to visit, it would be Japan. So I think for tech, Japan would definitely, or Tokyo would certainly be a place I'd want to go for that side. But personally, I think London's probably, outside of San Francisco, the biggest tech city.
Yeah, Japan's majorly on my bucket list. I think that just the history of the large electronics corporations there is fascinating, and how they've shaped the world. But London, I mean, it's great. I mean, I've just moved out of London, but living there is the buzz is awesome around Shoreditch, and the amount of innovation that's happening, and everyone's got a startup. It's very much like the Valley in that way. It's very cool. And I'm not surprised you said London. It's probably, to be honest, not to show any biases, probably my favorite too.
It helps being here, but maybe if I move to Japan, I'll change my mind.
Yeah. What about for when you're working, are you more of a music's podcasts or music man?
Music. I struggled to do two things at once. So I find if I'm listening to a podcast and working, I'll have to rewind it. And then I'm either not working or not listening. So I have to, I'll put some music. I do put on Daily Drive podcast on Spotify in the morning, just when I'm doing a bit of admin. That's quite interesting. So it's a mix of news and music. But yeah, generally it'd be music through the day.
Nice. And what was the last song you played on Spotify?
So Senses Fail released a new song today called Death by Water. So oh, I don't know if you remember Senses Fail.
It was one of the biggest
emo bands. So I still follow them. They're still making music, and they released a new one today, which is really good. So that's the last thing I listened to.
Yeah, I remember we were in that office at Talent. We were the only two sort of rock and metal heads. So a lot of good chats about that sort of stuff while everyone else. I was like, oh my God, it's just noise. Like,
yeah, and then put a Little Mix on instead.
He said, oh God, I miss some good times at Talent, but I do not miss the radio.
No, I have my headphones on pretty much 24/7.
Yeah, you and me both, mate. You and me both. What about in terms of like how the time of day, would you say you're more of an early bird or a night owl?
What, work-wise or just... Generally.
I guess both, yeah. Like generally being productive, whether that's work or not.
Yeah, I think I'm a night owl for sure. I don't like mornings very much. I think I now permanently work from home, so they're a lot easier. I don't have a commute to think about. So I'd probably move more towards the morning side, but I'm definitely a night owl in terms of just doing more in the evening. And I don't like mornings too much, so I'll have to go with that, I think, night owl.
Yeah, I'm definitely the same. And I think... the whole COVID situation and the move towards work from home has just made things so much easier for the night owls among us.
It's a good experiment for people being productive as well. So people are still productive. I think that was the fear of companies was people will be less productive, but I think they've shown that they're more productive if anything. So
yeah, I'm a huge believer in that. And I think allowing people to set what hours work best for them, not just for like, when they feel more productive, because I know a lot of devs in particular really do prefer working late at night, but then also as well being able to work it around commitments, like if you have a family or something like that, it can just make and if someone's life is easier, they're less stressed, they're going to be more productive, everyone wins, right?
For sure, yeah.
And what about less deep question here, when you're working throughout the day, coffee or tea?
Oh, coffee, 100%. I rarely have any milk, so just black coffee all day. I got an espresso machine now, so it's a little bit fancier, but yeah, definitely
moving
coffee.
Up in the world. Very nice. I don't have it as a quick fire question, but I do remember when we were working together, the traditional sort of 2 p.m trip to Tesco to buy those Cumberland sausages that were already made.
I don't miss that. My Monzo's changed. The yearly report we used to get. I think you'd been in Tesco more days in the year. So that meant you've had multiple trips each day.
Don't say that. My people I know are going to be listening to this.
You brought up the Cumberland sausage, not me.
Yeah, I did bring up. Yeah, it was
makes you feel a bit sick thinking about it. But
the fact that we no longer work in an office that was next door to a place that does that is probably very good for both of our health.
Yeah, definitely.
And final quick fire question: if you weren't working in the recruitment world at all, what do you think you'd be doing?
I don't really know. I kind of fell into recruitment, so it's almost, you know, what would I do? I've always been keen on drama and acting. Not necessarily pursued it too much, but I think I might have liked to have pursued that a bit more if it was a slightly more tangible career choice. But yeah, I've always enjoyed sort of drama or acting. So probably something in that. And I think if I was born maybe 10 years later, I might be an engineer, software engineer.
Okay.
I also did a games design course when I was younger. So I spent a lot of my youth not knowing what I wanted to do, so try and do a lot of different things, and then naturally landed into recruitment.
As is often the way.
Yeah, exactly.
same thing happened to me, basically. Still was trying to figure out what to do, but yeah, that's cool. It's an interesting variety of potential choices there.
Yeah,
so that kind of feeds quite nicely into the first question, really. I mean, what led to you working into the specific technical recruitment niche? Did you know someone in the industry already, or was it literally just falling into it one day?
Yeah, so I'm from a fairly small town in Devon called Newton Abbott. So in terms of work down there, there wasn't, you know, much outside of sort of retail or hospitality, but there was a company called Blue Glue that were an RPO. I had no idea what recruitment was, or tech really, but they were focused on startups in London, but working from Devon. So that's how I first got into that. And I think our bonus was £5 or higher, it went into a pot. So I didn't even know, you know, commission wise, oh great, a bit commission. But yeah, so that was my first job. That's how I kind of got into that. And it was very much focused on the startups in London in 2008, 2009. So around about financial crisis time, which was interesting. But it was interesting to see, you know, investment into startups. I didn't really know anything about startups. So that's how I first started in there. Again, it was a bit of an accident falling into recruitment. But you know, the idea of sales and what you might get at the end in terms of your commission was always nice. But I was really grateful to actually work in tech. So I think it's one of those things you're surrounded by, but you don't know how much of an interest you have in it until you're working around it. And I found it fascinating. So yeah, that's how I kind of first got into it.
Okay, cool. Sounds good. And for people that maybe aren't familiar, because the recruitment industry is very big in the UK, not so much elsewhere, can you explain kind of what a day-to-day difference is between someone who does what you do now, like working internally or working externally, either as a recruitment consultant or in an RPO setup?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, so obviously internally you're employed by the company you're hiring for. So obviously currently I'm at Form 3, so they've employed me to be a recruiter for them to bring talent into the team. And then externally, you'd be a recruitment agency. So you'd be kind of the middleman between the company and the candidates. So you're employed indirectly by the company. So you would take on the job briefs from them, source the candidates and act as a bridge between the two and taking the candidates through the process and obviously for a fee being an external company. Yeah, so that's the difference. So this is my first internal role and it's been great to actually see the people that I bring into the company and have interactions with them. But yeah, that's the difference between those two.
Yeah, it's a very interesting difference. I mean, I didn't do internal flat long. I did it once I knew I was going to leave it in a week. So it was quite a weird setup. I only did it for sort of 9 months or so. But yeah, it is very rewarding to bring people into an organization and help them sort of work their way up. And I mean, particularly the junior hires are extremely rewarding in that respect. And I don't know how much junior and entry level hiring you've done internally, but would you say there's anything in particular that, and I suppose this applies to your external days as well. And when we were working together at Talent, which is kind of in the middle, what would make a junior person stand out to you? Because we know that when you advertise a junior position, you get hundreds of applications in and it's very difficult to find the exact fit. Is there anything in particular you look out for?
Yeah, it is a tough one. I think, because it's not just about, you know, talking to them on the phone, it's about them actually getting to that point in the first place. Yeah, I think knowing what your interests are and focusing on that, if you're trying to spread yourself too thin, you could be coming across as particularly vague, and that's not too attractive to someone that's hiring in a particular area. So, you know, say if your interest is finance or if your interest is any kind of different kinds of tech, try and just focus on those companies, you know, build cover letters for those and make it relevant to that. But I think also know your worth as well. So I think that relates to knowing your interests. So, if, you know, don't sell yourself short for positions just because you want to get into the industry. Maybe spend a little bit longer actually working out what you want to do and focus on that. But, you know, it's very candidate driven at the moment. Maybe not so much for juniors. But I think taking that time to focus on what you want to do will be more rewarding for you, and it will come across more in an interview setting when you're actually talking about you know, your passion and working for companies like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, unfortunately, it's quite obvious when a candidate comes in with a scattergun approach of, you know, I'm just going to apply for a load of different jobs. And it is, I do remember that being a major red flag for me. And I think the more generally, the more you can tailor your application to someone. And I'm sure you'd agree with me here in that it's much better to apply for 10 jobs a week with an extremely detailed application where you've thoroughly researched a company versus 100 where you've just hit the quick apply now. And I wish job boards didn't have that option, really.
Yeah, I mean, it might get you into some place. I think the other thing is just build connections as well. And if there's people you know, mentorship, take on mentors that can help you within the industry. Because like you said, there are a lot of people and it's hard to individualize everybody when you're going for applications, which is what you want to do. But if you have a lot, it's hard to do that. So maybe if you have a mentor or you have people within the industry who can put you in touch with people directly, you know, referrals are huge. That's if you're referred by somebody that someone knows, it's a huge gain. So that might be something to look at as well. Is go to events, you know, maybe not in COVID times, but try and go to as many events as you can and get in touch with people and build a network. And those referrals will, yeah, really help.
Yeah, it's definitely the highest success rate is someone referring someone else in terms of if a candidate will succeed in an organization. And I'm really glad you said that about events, because really just putting yourself out there and speaking to people, it's an industry where luckily people are very nice and people are always looking to help each other out. In fact, I remember my first week as an agent, as a recruitment agent, doing stuff externally. An agency I worked for had a few cowboys working for them. And one of them said to me, he was explaining what Stack Overflow was. And he said, yeah, it's very strange. Developers like to help each other. It's quite weird like that.
Well, that's someone who spent a long time in external recruitment.
Yeah, not all external recruiters are like that at all, but that quote will always stick with me.
Yeah, that's what the open source community is about, right? That's why engineering is so brilliant, because it's a smart, it's like a science as well, isn't it? People want to evolve and they want to move the industry forward. And the way you can do that is through collaborating. So that's why it's a really interesting industry.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad you brought up open source as well, because that is another really great way for you to get noticed if you're a junior. Because, you know, open source, it doesn't mean you have to be working on a new version of React or doing some high performance computing mad stuff. Like, you know, I'm a mid-level and I wouldn't have a clue about that stuff. You can do stuff like translating. Like, say if English isn't your native language, you can bet the documentation needs to be in another language. And if you're bilingual, then that's a great way you can help out.
Yeah.
And you still get listed as a contributor. People love to see you contributing to the wider ecosystem. And I could say from my time as a recruiter, and I'm sure you'd agree, that's an amazing way to stand up the CV is contributing to open source.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've recently hired a technical writer as well. It's the first time I've already done that. But obviously that's another way into the industry, is working on API documentation and being around engineers. And that can be a path in as well if it's not clear that you can get in straight away on the junior level. Maybe look at roles around the tech team and in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And anyone that's maybe decided to transition from like a marketing background, you're at a real advantage there. The skills are very close together. You can get in through doing technical writing, developer relations, and that sort of thing is a great way forward. And those jobs are, there's more of them now, basically, because companies are realizing the value of having a good sort of open source and tooling brand, instead of just having amazing proprietary software. Just having it really clear and open is a great way forward. So yeah, there's a ton of stuff that can help you stand out as a junior. And obviously as well, when we were at Talent, there were sort of 30 of us in the room. And if someone had a good personal website, I remember there was one where, I don't remember the guy's name, and I wouldn't name it on the podcast anyway for privacy reasons, but it was really cool. He had a picture of his face, and his face followed you around where your cursor was.
Yeah, that was great. And then there was another guy who made almost like a sort of Mario World CV, and you actually had to go through, it's like a platformer, and you had to go through it, and it gave him like your skills, or was the first level, and then his like work history was the next level. That was really, really cool as well.
Yeah, anything like that, it just gets passed around the office and people love it, and they're going to be more motivated to get your job. And you can use all kinds of like libraries and that sort of thing to impress a recruiter in the construction of your website. Like, it doesn't have to be something super under the hood. Like, there's plenty of cool libraries to be able to do that kind of thing. We're talking about positive stuff now. Have you got any, obviously thoroughly anonymized, any horror stories of something crazy a candidate has done?
Horror story? I'm just trying to think if I could say any of them. There's not been anything mad. I think it's things like attitude sometimes has been very strange, like the defensive nature of people. But I also think that if you're going through a lot of stressful recruitment processes, rejection can be hard. And I could have been the 10th one of that day. And then, you know, that can be the outburst. But I've heard a story of one guy who ended up running a minicab company from the office's car park that he was contracting at.
I absolutely love that.
Yeah, contract software engineer, and he was always on his phone looking out the window, and they found out that he was just running a minicab business from the car park.
That is genius.
Yeah.
I've heard that is better than the best one I've heard, because I heard a similar one where a guy was a candidate, but he was a software engineer, so he was a legitimate candidate, but he also owned his own recruitment agency. So he would try and sell you candidates basically when he was in the process.
Oh, wow.
So he'd be competing against himself. So it was kind of like a really clever insurance policy, because he knew it'd get a fee either way, which I thought was genius, to be honest. Yeah. And there's no law against it. It's a weird loophole.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I guess you can do that for a certain bit, can't you? Then just get a job. Let's go for the last one.
And anyone listening, that stuff catches up to you, and the industry, industry is very small. Like, people will notice, like, as genius again as it is.
Yeah.
Do not run a minicab office from your desk while you're working.
Yeah, exactly. Don't have a burner phone which you're running the business from either.
Yeah. Exactly. That's crazy. So I guess if you're being contacted as an engineer, either by an internal or external agent, I guess this doesn't really matter either way. What are some kind of flags to look out for, either green or red flags, to know if this is a good or a bad opportunity? Is there anything that you would advise from your side?
Yeah, I think transparency for in any kind of advert or contact you're receiving. So I think from an internal point of view anyway, we work quite hard on our emails to try and make them as tailored as possible, depending on how many people you're reaching out to, but also just to be as informative as possible. So I think how transparent the company are with their information on what the role is, what your responsibility would be, why they reached out to you. But also things like tech stack on these companies, how you see a lot with just everything listed. And that would say to me the company hasn't looked at your profile to understand where you'd fit within that sort of ecosystem. So I think, well-tailored information that is sent to you, and they have the person has a good grasp of what their company does as well. Because again, if it's an agency recruiter and they're reaching out to you something, obviously they're naturally going to be quite vague to a degree, because they have to protect their own interests of the company before they speak to you. But I think if you can get a good gauge that they understand what that role is and what the company does, is important, because otherwise you're going to be on a call with them trying to talk to them about why you're relevant for that position, and they won't even know it themselves. So it could be a waste of time. I think transparency from a company from the beginning, and their own knowledge of what they're trying to introduce to you and why you're relevant for it is good.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think if people are kind of playing, like word soup and just chucking random things in an email, like I get the weird trend I've been having recently is recruiters messaging me and saying, listing this tech stack and saying like, oh, if you fit the bill, then message me back. And it's
lazy,
it'll
isn't
be
it?
Stuff that I've never touched. Yeah. And they'll be like, if it's I get stuff for like DevOps and I get CTO ones and that sort of thing. It's very strange.
It either shows they haven't looked at your profile, or they don't know what they're hiring for. It could be the other end. You could be getting CTOs getting junior developer roles because they've been part of a mass in-mail send out. So that would be a red flag for sure. If you read it and you feel like this really sounds like me, then that's a great start. I think that's what you should try to work out, if this sounds like what you're doing or what you want to do. That would be the first thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think particularly in a situation where the recruiter reaches out to you as internal as well, I would advise any junior, like, don't be afraid to ask questions about the company culture and that sort of thing, because one, it shows genuine interest, and two as well, it allows the recruiter to sell it properly to you, and you can get a real sense of what that organization is like to work for. Because you don't always want to, a company might be a good company, but it might not be a good fit for you. Like, it's not a binary situation from either side of the table.
Yeah. And I think, like you said there with the culture side of things, I really like it when candidates ask, what is the culture like? Maybe not that vague, but they want to understand what the working culture is like, especially because I work for a fully remote business. I think it's important for people to understand how that works. Any questions around culture shows again that you're more interested than just the nuts and bolts of the role. You want to know how it works, and go on Glassdoor, have a look at reviews on there for companies, and that should give you a true understanding of the interview process and also people that already work there. So check those reviews out as well, too.
Yeah, for sure, absolutely, and it can bring up some good talking points. And particularly a red flag is if you bring up the Glassdoor reviews and the recruiter gets defensive. That's always a clear one.
It's an interesting one, because obviously the reviews are on there for the interview process as well, so you can get a lot of people who are negative because they've been rejected. But it's also very important to listen to that, because you want to understand the reason why they're not happy, because it could be something within your process which isn't right. Time or feedback isn't right, so it's important to take those into effect as well, but also understand that people can be defensive on that side.
Yeah, absolutely. It's worth considering that as well, is that a lot of the time people that do leave, it's always worth checking Glassdoor. But remember, people either leave a review if things have gone really well or really badly. Always keep that in mind. That's kind of something worth keeping in mind. And we touched on the interview process a little bit. What's the process for someone who's an engineer, a candidate at Form 3? How does it work from start to finish?
Yeah, it's quite streamlined, to be honest. So the first would be a call with someone in the talent team. So it's myself, essentially. And that would be to go through the role, obviously, and talk about their experience and what they might be interested in. We have a candidate document we send out as well before, which lists, which is really good. It's all branded, and it lists all of our technologies, how our teams work, and kind of really appreciate that. It's a lot of information before the call. Following that, they'll then be sent a technical test, which they complete in their own time. It's all done through GitHub. And they have as long as they need to do that, because we don't necessarily just hire for Go engineers. We hire for people who are sort of polyglots or have an interest in Go, because it's not the biggest market in terms of available candidates. But because we only hire for senior engineers, we feel we don't need to ask people to have a particular language. If they've been working 10 years, it's probably the easy thing an experienced engineer can do is pick up a new language, especially if it's got a similar syntax to it or whatever it might be. But yeah, so they'll do the technical test, and that's where we probably have most people falling down, because it is to a fairly high standard. It's reviewed by two of our engineers who are currently in the company. They review it together and then provide feedback on that. If that's passed, then it'll go through to the final stage, and that's in three parts for 30 minutes at a time, and they'll meet three different senior engineers to cover different things. So they'll talk through the technical test, ask some questions about why they did things in a certain way, and then there will be a kind of debugging exercise in there as well, because we have people on call, so it's understanding how you might deal with a problem if you're on call. But that's it really. So it's quite a condensed process, and I think it works really well. Obviously now we're growing a lot, we have to think about the structure of bringing people back in who have maybe failed the test in the past, because we don't let people retake that after any certain amount of time. But obviously being 5 years now, those people who have failed earlier on in the process could be experienced engineers. So that's an area we're looking at. But I think it's a really good setup, because it's not talking to six people in four different interviews. It's very structured. You talk to me, then you do a test, and then you speak to some engineers, and that's the whole process.
Yeah, that sounds really good, and clearly defined is the most important bit, because having some clarity from the candidate side, and again, candidates who developers who are listening, who are maybe applying for jobs right now, absolutely don't be afraid to ask the recruiter what the process is and what it's like, because it shows interest from your side. And you can also, if they don't have a process, you know that this might be a bit of a wild roller coaster.
Yeah, especially with startups. I mean, startups tend to start bringing people into the process, and I remember it being a talent, it was just like banging your head against the wall. It's like you need to define this before you start, because you can't, these people also are in high demand, they've got a lot of options on the table. You might be their favorite, but they need to start thinking about timelines, and you can't ask them to wait another 2 weeks if they've already got an offer somewhere else. That's why I go back to transparency and that kind of thing with candidates. It's really important that you're getting that from the person you're talking to at the company. If they're vague or they're not really giving you information, there's probably something else going on, which is a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a big sort of green flag if you're dealing with a recruiter and they're very transparent with you. And especially with internal recruiters, give that back in transparency. Yeah. The one thing where I would say don't be transparent is if you're working with an external recruiter and they're like, just out of interest, what are the other jobs what's happening there is you're going to get five CVs competing against you coming in the next morning. Yeah. So don't do that.
Yeah, just let them know where you are in the process for those ones and what the salary is. They're the two things they need to compete with, and that's all they need to know from that point
of view. Yeah, even if there's a bit of pressure, don't give the name and don't give a reference at the first stage.
Yeah, it's not necessary.
Yeah, it's a sales tactic, and it's one of the best ways that external recruiters use to gather up new leads. But don't be afraid of working with external recruiters equally.
No, that's just not. I think our time at Talent showed that having people who are focused on, say if you're in a particular area, say like you said, DevOps, or you're a cloud engineer, that can be quite niche. You're going to be well off working with a recruiter who's spent a lot of time in that industry, because ultimately they want you to find a position. So I think working with specialist recruiters is still 100% relevant.
Yeah, definitely. If you have I actually had another guest on the podcast the other day, Joe, who is a DevOps specialist recruiter, and we were talking about the importance of working with a couple of trusted partnered recruiters throughout your career can really accelerate things on both sides, and that's the approach he's trying to promote as much as possible.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, it's hard for everyone to do that especially in London, for the amount of recruiters there are. Yeah. but see those people out. Maybe even talk to your friends who have been hired through recruiters and talk to them about who helped them.
Yeah, and also that's a win-win, because you'll often get some cash if you do that. So
back to referrals.
All the Amazon vouchers. Yeah, this world is a wash with tax-deductible Amazon vouchers. So if you know where to look, you'll never have to worry about getting random bits off Amazon ever again. Yeah. Cool. And we're kind of talking about the vacancies here, and the kind of elephant in the room, and something's it's kind of been the zeitgeist recently here in the UK, and I'm sure listeners in other parts of the world that the same conversation will be going on in your country, is the fact that we have a digital skills gap where we have lots of vacancies, but we don't quite have the right amount of people who are upskilled to take up those vacancies, and therefore we kind of have a coiled spring in the economy here where, yes, we already have a great tech ecosystem in the UK, but we could become the best with the potential that we have. If you were in charge, Sam, how do you think you would promote it, and what kind of policies, both public and private, would be effective?
Oh, really putting the world to rights here, aren't we?
Big question. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a very hard one. It's because it's balancing, like you said, the trained people you have and the experience you have now with the time you have. So it's impossible to give someone 5 years experience now. You can't do that. But obviously, I think people are, because the technology ecosystem is advancing much quicker than it would have done when you're working on Perl or Cobalt. You know, that's those things were around for a long time. But now you have languages changing all the time. So I think people's experience is becoming probably more valuable in a shorter amount of time. But I think teaching at a young age is really important. So I don't know if you're the same, but I know there's a slight age difference between us. But when I was back at school, it was information technology. We learned how to make spreadsheets, and that was about it. There was no computer science, but now you have, you know, things like Raspberry Pi in schools, and you have children in primary school learning computer science, which never had the opportunity to do that myself. I would love to have had that. And I think that will give people, you know, give young people an interest in and be fascinated by that. Because I think it's impossible not to be fascinated by technology and things that are doing that. And then if they have a spark in them, they want to be part of building that. That's the best place to do it. But obviously that's going to take a long time for that to then come through to the pool. So I think currently it's hard. It's about accessibility, giving it to the widest audience possible. So talking about diversity and inclusion, you know, it's a huge area to bring more people in from that side. And then you're helping diversity and inclusion as well. So it's a win-win on both sides. I just think it's hard to want people to be experienced now, because that's not going to happen. So it's about how do you make it more accessible and have more interest around it in the next 5 to 10 years. So I don't have a quick fix for it now. I don't know what the plaster is for this problem. I think it's just about continuing to make it accessible to as many people as possible. I don't think it's always been that way. So the more people it's accessible to, the more people it reaches, more people become interested in it and actually pursue it as a career, following on from that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think the fact your answer was focused on early education and children is really important, because kids' brains are like sponges, right? And I was the same case of you. I mean, I was born in 95, so I turned 26 a few weeks ago. And, you know, I was in school in the late noughties and left in 2013. And, you know, we stopped doing IT in year eight. So for those who aren't from the UK, that's when you're about 13 years old. So it's very early on. And I had a similar experience, just spreadsheets, really. So what I have heard now is that, yeah, exactly. I've heard Raspberry Pi is being taught, which is great. And even younger than that, stuff like Scratch, like if you're listening and you've got a kid yourself, MIT has released Scratch, which is totally free and open source as a fun little way to program small things in basically blocks for kids. And, you know, any kid that's sort of 6 or 7 or older will be able to handle it. And it's about planting that seed of curiosity with a kid and making them not intimidated by technology. And before you know it, they're going to be hacking and that sort of thing when they're a teenager.
Ethical hacking, of course.
Ethical hacking. But yeah, it's about building the comfort, because you don't have to fear so much when you're a kid. It's like it's like when you're doing some kind of like, if you're learning to, weird example, if you learn to skateboard or something, like I would be terrified of learning to skateboard now, because you're foolhardy.
Because you know what will happen.
Yeah. I was terrified the first time I opened the terminal because I thought I'd break my computer, and because I didn't do that until I was 22.
Yeah.
Whereas if I was 9, although don't let your kid use a terminal without you supervising them. So please don't sue me if you lose all your documents or your machine gets bricked. Like that, they're not going to have the intimidation and be scared. And then, you know, that's the best way to help. And I think promoting things like apprenticeships as well is a great way forward. You know, if I ran a business, I would definitely hire sort of apprentices after leaving school, because it's a great way to earn some money and learn some skills.
Well, I think the idea is the gaps at the top, isn't it, with the experience? Well, that's what the idea is. And that's not, you can't fix that. What you can do is put in place, do you need to have the most experienced person for what you're building? Or can you, like you said, give opportunities to people who are, there's a lot of junior people out there, you know, things like Lewagon and, you know, all the different coding schools, which are excellent, but it's also meaning there are more people on the junior end of things. So maybe working out how you can restructure your own way of building things within your company, which will give opportunities to those people, maybe more, you know, a bigger team, but more juniors in there. It's a hard one, because ultimately the more complex things you want to build, you need someone with experience. But do you need all the people with the experience, or can you have a team which is made up of, you know, what, both ends?
It's the chicken and egg question, but stuff like bringing in, I think once you get to a certain size, a junior in is an investment, and if you treat them well, they'll stay with you. And reverse mentoring is a big thing as well, where senior engineers learn things from juniors.
Like, 100%,
even me, I've only been doing this full time for like not even quite 2 years yet, and the amount I've learned from people that learned to code this year, it's crazy.
That's what we were saying about, you know, open source stuff, it moves so quickly, and I think that's where you have, I talked to a lot of senior engineers who have had to go from things like Perl into, or even if, you know, not even that as old as that, things like PHP, which is obviously huge. It was huge. The whole of the internet was built on PHP, but then the idea of actually still being a PHP developer and wanting to build something robust is, you know, doesn't work that way. So you have to be adaptable within the industry. So the person that's got 15 years experience might not actually have as much experience in the language you want as someone who's got 3, because they'll be working with that language consistently for 3 years. Whereas the person with 15 years experience has only just started to learn that. So yeah, I think it's identifying the skill sets.
Yeah, that's a very important point and something worth keeping in mind as a junior. Like, don't be intimidated, because something like PHP was riding high and was the gold standard. You know, Facebook, which is the most successful technology company of all time, in my opinion, and the most innovative, was built on PHP. Yeah. And now PHP is, honestly, it's considered a bit of a meme. And people laugh at it in the programming community. And, even when I was still recruiting, we were moving away from it then. And it's
very digital agency, isn't it? That's the thing. It's made for campaigns and made for landing pages and that kind of thing more.
Exactly. And now there's more modern tools for that. So definitely you're better off learning something that isn't PHP.
Yeah. And don't learn Flash as well. Now. I'm not even sure Flash is still running, is it?
I think Flash has either just been officially retired or will be retired. Flash is, JavaScript, I think, has won. I think would be safe to say. Learning, for me, the best way to sum it up is like, either learn JavaScript or Python first and then take it from there, because there is a world. But what you've talked about with Go/Golang, that is actually my sort of hot tip. If you're already a programmer, try and learn that, because the market for it is popping off and there's some really cool companies using it.
Yeah, it's even things like Rust as well and those more niche ones. But I think even if you're starting out learning things, C++, even though it's kind of gold standard, but it's not just about learning a particular language, like about learning the syntax of that language and how that's relevant to other, because every language has evolved from a different language or takes things from other languages. So the more you're exposed to, the more you understand the nuances of different ones, and they're going to help you ultimately when you continue to learn. I guess it's like learning languages in terms of spoken languages as well. They all have attachments to each other. I only speak English, but I imagine they all have attachments to each other.
I'm the same, yes.
Yeah. So once you've learned one, it becomes easy to learn more, because you can see the relationship between different ones and how they take things from each other.
Yeah, because you have to learn the concept of things like variables and loops and that sort of thing. It's just the implementation is different. And and also the further down the sort of tree you go, in my opinion, the gold standard of how to learn to code in 2021 is what I could call this podcast title, is Harvard CS50 course. So it's a class from Harvard, which is 100% free to take for anyone in the world. And they do a bit of Scratch to start you off. It's quite funny because it is literally like 0 to 100. They start you off with Scratch, which is really fun, like graphical, like you create fun little games with it. And then you learn C. And is like, it is tough. However, it's the fundamentals. And once you understand how C works, it makes the whole thing easier. And it's very deliberately set out in that way, because once you do C in the Harvard course, they then bring you in stuff like JavaScript and Python, which then becomes so much easier. And I remember when we were working at Talent, that's when I was doing the C. So if you ever looked at me on one of our lunch hours sitting at my desk and crying, it's probably because I was trying to code C.
When you're doing your doing your Lil Peep tribute.
Yeah. That was my first. God, that was really showing how aged it is. When my first website ever made. In fact, you were the first person to see anything I ever coded. So
yeah. I think I was very polite, wasn't I?
I think you were quite polite. Yeah.
I was like, oh, it is your first, yeah.
Yeah, it is my first. It was literally like a year 7 IT project. but yeah, it was. Do you know what? I actually stumbled across that on GitHub the other day, and it is shocking when you see the code you've written.
It's good though, isn't it? Because you can look at something like that and be like, it's amazing how far you've come on that and what you're doing now. So I think it's probably a good thing to look back on those things sometimes and be like, that's where you were, and this is what you can do now.
Absolutely, yeah. It's like climbing a mountain, and then, you know, you're still only halfway up. You're perpetually, that's the thing about engineering. It's a paradox that the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know.
Yeah.
But you've got to look down the mountain occasionally and realize how far you've climbed.
Yeah, definitely, sure.
That's the same as life. So on that philosophical note, our lunch hours are rapidly coming to an end, and I think we both need a bite to eat. So it's been really awesome. Well, just catching up with you generally, mate. But the insights you've given have been fantastic. And do you want to just give some details about like Form 3, any kind of vacancies, the best way to get in touch with you, and what people can do?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure talking about that. So with Form 3, we a huge drive on the engineering side. So any software engineers or senior software engineers at the moment who work with Golang or anything Java, Python, who are interested in cloud-based software, please apply. And you can find us on form3.tech. Our careers page is on there, and you can apply through there or search for any of the talent partners on LinkedIn. And someone will come back to you on that. I'm particularly now working in product, so any product managers, business analysts, if you're in payments, excellent. If not, then please still feel free to reach out and let me know. We'll be hiring across operations and all the teams, really, and we're even looking for people within talent as well. We've started to look at different areas geographically, so UK, I think we're hiring for at the moment. So if anyone's out there who's a recruiter maybe looking to go internal, then feel free to reach out to myself on LinkedIn or go for our careers page.
Fantastic. And Form 3 is fully remote, right?
Yeah, we do have an office in London and an office in Amsterdam. So we have an office in London, you can work from whatever you like, but ultimately it's work from home. We're a remote first company, so we have an office, but we're remote first.
Fantastic. That sounds great. So what I'll do is I'll put Form 3's details in the description of the podcast and Sam's contact details as well. But yeah, and until next time, thanks very much, Sam. It's been great having you on. And this has been Cam with the Coder Career. You can subscribe to us here on your podcast feed of choice, to our YouTube channel. And if I've configured the service correctly, the website should be up, but probably not. So stay tuned on that. And thanks again. See you next time.